Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a reading and conversation titled, There Lives the Dearest Freshness Deep Down Things. Tonight's event is presented by Boston University's Institute for Human Sciences and Center for International Relations in cooperation with the literary journal AGNI. Speaking will be poets Saskia Hamilton and Kieran Wynn. Our moderator is Christopher Ricks, William M. and Sarah B. Warren Professor of the Humanities at Boston University. We begin with an introduction by Professor Vivian Schmidt, Director of Boston University's Center for International Relations.
It's a great honor tonight to be able to introduce our speakers. Kieran Wynn was educated at Tonbridge School, where he later briefly taught, and at Christ Church, Oxford, where he was awarded a doctorate for a thesis on Herbert Reed and T.S. Eliot. His poems have appeared in magazines including Agenda, The Dark Horse, The London Magazine, Oxford Magazine, Oxford Poetry, Poetry Review, The Rialto, and The Spectator, and in a short film about his work on BBC One. A selection of his poems appears in the Carcanet Anthology, Oxford Poets, 2007. He was awarded the University of Oxford's English Poem on a Sacred Subject Prize in 2007. He lives in Oxford, where he's a freelance teacher. Saskia Hamilton is the author of two books of poetry, As for Dream, 2001, and Divide These, 2005. She is also the editor of the Letters of Robert Lowell, 2005, and a co-editor of Words in the Air, the complete correspondence between Elizabeth Bishop and Robert Lowell, 2008. She's the recipient of a Bunting Fellowship from the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. She teaches at Barnard College, Columbia University, and lives in New York City. This evening's moderator, Christopher Ricks, is the William M. and Sarah B. Warren Professor of the Humanities at Boston University. He was elected Professor of Poetry at Oxford in 2004 and is known both for his critical studies and for his editorial work. And without further ado, I hand it over to Christopher Ricks. And
thank you very much. My pleasure in welcoming on our behalf our two poets is the greater in that I didn't play any part in inviting them. I don't mean that I would have balked at inviting them. I like very much the fact that the choice of them as our poets is quite independent of me, but confirms my sense that they are very good poets indeed. As the Professor of Poetry at Oxford, not a poet, I felt it right that I should have in each term, three times for the 5 years, therefore, both an Oxford poet and an American poet who would come over and read for us in Oxford. Saskia Hamilton was on one occasion the American poet, as was David Ferry, George Calogeros, who I'm delighted to see in the room this evening, and many other poets towards whom I have both friendship and admiration. Kieran Wynn was one of the Oxford poets whom I invited, so it's a particular pleasure to me to have this coinciding. I will be very brief in introducing them. We've heard the facts well related to us. Alphabetical order mattered to me in Oxford as uninvidious, so I think we'll observe that tonight, and I'll start by saying something about Saskia Hamilton. The combination in her poems of modesty and mystery. They're very succinct, they're often cryptic and even enigmatic. Succinct in the sense that you tuck your clothes up, etymologically, you tuck your clothes up so that you can move with ease and grace, as these poems do. She is not afraid of the unobvious. Kieran Wynn is a Wordsworthian poet. He's a poet to whom Wordsworth matters a very great deal, both aspects of Wordsworth, the Wordsworth who writes of an ordinary sorrow of man's life, and the Wordsworth who writes of joy in widest commonality spread. He has learnt, Kieran has learnt from Wordsworth what Philip Larkin learnt from Hardy, not to be afraid of the obvious. So there's a beautiful pairing, I think, and complementarity tonight. Poetry readings don't need moderators, though it is true that if William Carlos Williams and T.S. Eliot had read on the same occasion, you would have done well to have a moderator. And if Geoffrey Hill and Philip Larkin were to read on the same occasion, you would need not a moderator but a referee, and even seconds to stanch the blood. So I'll reserve being any kind of moderator for the discussion part of our evening's occasion. Our poets will read for 15 minutes or so, and then we will see what they wish to say to one another and what we wish to say to them and to hear them say back to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Christopher. And thank you to Vivian Schmidt. And it's a real pleasure to read with Kieran Wynn, whom I heard read Balliol a year ago with Rosanna Warren, Boston University's own. I'm going to read tonight from a book-length collection of poems not yet finished entitled Nightjar. And as many of you will know, that is a bird that looks like a hawk, flies at night like an owl, but is actually related to the swifts, to the hirondelles. It's quite a mysterious creature. Another interesting fact about nightjars is that when they make their call, which is a bit like somebody running a few yards of cloth through a sewing machine, they can throw their voice, they're ventriloquists. So if you hear it and you look over there, it's probably over there somewhere. And the place where I've seen one once only and heard one several times is in the Fen country in the eastern part of the Netherlands, near the German border, where I've been every year since I was three. And the bird doesn't appear in every poem necessarily. It's more of a tutelary spirit of the book. And what else can I tell you? The landscapes are this part of Holland. The Netherlands. My Dutch uncle Otto would chastise me for calling it Holland, because it's not one of the provinces of Holland. It's one of the provinces of the Netherlands, Gelderland, France, Britain, and of course the U.S. Nightjar. In the first field, a man turns the hay. Not wrapped. Where there's ricks, there's gates. Six. Sufficient to the sojourner. To the day. We parked by the fourth field and descended the path cut by rainwater through fern, bark, and sticks. Litter of old walls where the forest encroached on dwelling. Down in the church, named for the saint, named for stone, the villagers of Thanatos, packed in, lie below the raised floor, feet stretched tentatively at the chancel. Tarp covers their teeth and jaws. Lichen and mold, blue, the grinning lion, fish and worm. And outside, in the cleared valley, dandelion and poppies seed, unto the hour sufficient. The late long one begins in the wood. The bird's call seems to turn, though it is still in its bracken. Its round eye, somewhere in there, takes in the dark under the blackening canopy of branches. Reversal, portal. Hawking for moths at dusk, the nightjar in the fen near the worn stone markers of the old bishopric. Thence seeded to centuries of the forest. Thence the fall, one by one. Thence centuries underfoot of branch and brush and peat. Near you, but where it has gone, past the rides. I'm going to try out some quite new poems on you, and I hope you survive, and I survive. my latest series in the sequence are a series of three poems, and I should just say that they three brief poems on a single page. The he's and she's don't necessarily interact or interrelate. They might, but it's not really narrative. These three are grouped. Each of the threes are sort of grouped together for other reasons, other things that interested me. For example, in the first one, I was interested in silent ways of acknowledging something or vowing something through gesture. He took what was to be his final walk in the Woldsefein late winter, snow receding, the silver tip of his cane now broad, now narrow. Just beyond the path in the bracken, he knelt and sat on the ground as in a vowel, the watch wrapped in linen. If she ever acknowledged the name, it was only when no one was there to hear it. The silence sheltered something at home that had troubled the petitioner. He had fallen on the way, late as usual, needed tending. Never explain, he only ever said. She knelt and pulled the cloth from the mud. Linnet, she heard and named. The water eddied and pooled at her shoes. The bird, not visible, warm gray movement in the thicket. What else lay there the day at its end? Squelch of mud when she rose. Strip of linen clinging to her boot. So here's another one of the threes, and I was just interested in the word next, because next, I think I read in Private Eye or somewhere like that, making fun of instructions in railway carriages where the language gets so convoluted that it says, pull the lever adjacent to the door, or something like that. And I was, of course, it should just be simply next or something. And then I thought about next as being, you know, nice because it's about it can refer to a sequence or proximity. He stands at the edge, and crows rise from the field. The eastern side is cast in shadow. In the far pasture, sheep crowd in a circle. All are at rest, and yet nothing has yet been harvested. All wait for next day's work. Next patient, he says. They file through from the waiting room. Penitent? He turns to the attending and wakes. Beyond the house, a car moves along the south road. He races to dress, then sits on the bed, being no longer expected. 3 weeks pass before she feels able to face it and is sorry for having said yes. Should she consult the volumes whose plain type shelters the labor of thousands? Dawn. On her desk, Mirandi's objects herd together on a postcard next to a jar of pencils. Bells woke us at 8, set us to table at 7. Very late, we'd switch on the electric blanket, and he would take off his shirt, my mouth on him. He took in the many mouths, windows open, all ajar, all tongues. This one has two voices, and the clever one's not mine. Milk violet flies up from the wall on its mazy way to grass. If I call, I'll find you someplace en route, pausing at a shop window to gaze at the small article, dolphin coin, numismatic remains, vegetables, radios, recycled clothing. John obviously wants to interfere with her, but he keeps changing his mind all the time because he lives in a world where nothing ever happens. I fear he's about to enter a Shakespearean subplot. If I call, you will be in the bath, up and flipping your coin of story. As her every sentence bears witness, but then each sentence has too many exits. The bicycle rests against the low wall, jutting its front wheel onto the road, white tire bluing at dusk, aerospace, velospace, old transatlantic cable. This one has a quotation from, dare I say it, the man himself, Beckett, stolen from him. But it is in quotation marks, so I'll acknowledge it somewhere. And this is extremely minor compared to, obviously, the greatness that is Beckett. January rain, odd season. The day is over there. A dog bays at traffic. Trucks come up the road from the bridge bearing heads of lettuce to the city. Rain falters, lessens, then much, then little, then nothing. You are sleeping now, undone in the bedclothes over there. Here's one of the threes again. This is a small country, he said. There are too many trains. And then they get old and things break down, and the system is complex, and that makes for breaks and failures. Plants encroach on the tracks, the land encroaches, sweet gale, cotton grass. On Monday, she surveyed the calendar, tabling the hours of departure for the first and last trains between the three cities that sprawled together. If I miss the connection, she said, I can wait and have a coffee inside. Pigeons walked platform 7 for the 0828. The moss encroached on trees, giant beech, slender beech. Old leaves encroached. Ivy and holly joined in dominion. One birch marked itself. Another signaled from afar. Leaves in ruts, leaves in ditches, ditch water, and water on the path leading either out of the forest or further within. Are you surviving, by the way? These strange things. You're being very kind to take these in. Midsummer rain, then again, numbering the days. Then 40 more of heavy air. They arrange the order of the internal forest of hours in your absence. Or is it ours? The numbers fall short. In the shelter of the church, faces stare out of 5 leafy capitals. They do not speak their alarm. The donkey's ears rounding the bending road to Egypt. The angel falling headfirst into the Virgin's womb. Inside their mouths of stone, do the dead yield? The tractor turns its giant forks to the field. Seed sorter, seed fixer, sacked. Petrochemical, body, the gut. Time to build a hospital for travelers. It's one more of the threes. She made a cup of tea and took up pencil and book, reading lines aloud, ticking the good ones. She then smoked half a cigarette, pinched it closed, put it back in the packet. It's probably a big mistake, she said aloud, but couldn't place the remark. My bad conscience was nothing other than terrible vanity, he said in interview. And I was terribly cruel. So I don't have anything to do with conscience now. They went outdoors and stood by the boats on shore, pointing at outness. When the phone rang, she spoke to her sister for hours. I would go so far as to say, she would say. She watched as neighbors from across the way moved past their windows. The room grew darker. Insofar as, she would say. She went as far as that. Just 2 more poems. This is the last one from the Nightjar. Hodgepodge. I dreamt I wrote to X around the borders of a piece of hatched paper he had written on. Alternate wheat and fallow, some exhaustion land. It is said that after paradise, after a time, the unfallen animals came down the road and went their separate ways. Peacock, boar, pheasant, rabbit. Small birds roved the fields and hedges, expanding understories of holly and woodlands, spitting rain, successes and lapses. Plots have in the drawing. Plans for second floor passages in the first house. Wheat begins growing. And then lastly, with fear and trembling in this august audience, a version, very much a version, not a translation, of an Anglo-Saxon riddle. This is riddle 39. They've never been able to figure out what the answer to it is, although they have some guesses. So this is my, I hope not terrible, butchering of riddle 39. It is written in scriptures that this creature appears plainly to us when the hour calls, while its singular power compels and confounds our knowing. It seeks us out, one by one, following its own way, fares on with its stranger's step, never there a second night, native to no place, moves according to its nature. It has no hands, no feet, has never touched the ground, no mouth to speak of, nor mind. Scriptures say it is the least of anything made. It has no soul, no life, but travels widely among us in this world. No blood, nor bone, but consoles all the children of men. It hasn't reached heaven, it won't touch hell, but takes instruction from the King of Glory. The whole story of its fate, limbless as it is, animate, is too obscure to tell. And yet, all the words we find to describe it are just and true. If you can say it, call it by its rightful name. Thank you.
I'm very, very happy to be here. I'm very grateful for being invited. It'll be nice to say some of these quietly. Last time I said these in England, I had to shout in a college hall in Oxford. So I'm glad of a good mic. I'm very grateful to be here. I've had a fantastic 10 days all over Massachusetts, including a couple of notable poetic moments, one of which was when I was sitting in Amherst, minding my own business, and Richard Wilbur, whose work I love, walked past. And if you don't know Richard Wilbur's work, I think he's a wonderful American poet. He's 88, but still strong as an oak. And I bothered him briefly, and he was very charming. And I urge you to read Wilbur, if you don't already. And yesterday I was taken round the Dry Salvages, which you may know are the subject of the third of Eliot's four quartets. I've now seen all four quartet sites, and they are uncanny, all of them. I'm going to read about a dozen poems, the first of which is sometimes taken as ironic, but I don't mean it as ironic. The gentleman bowls along. The gentleman bowls along, and flourishing his cane creates new symbols in the morning air. His face is sanguine pink, his waistcoat half unbuttoned. His liquid eyes reflect stout cattle, orderly hedge. His brimming heart spills some runaway laughter. With happiness to hand in breathing, seeing, paradise for man cannot be far away. Legends. The day that you and I first played those songs, whose bright fragments lay scattered through our lives, in pubs, at parties, next to building sites, I thought that heaven rebuilt from far-flung blocks, love's perfection, all things fully known, would be like Penny Lane or Shall We Dance, all the way through in the soaring, pure performance, loud and clear, as often as we want. My parents have now moved to Cornwall, on the western tip of England. And I suppose the nearest thing to here, pretty much. We used to holiday there as a family when I was a boy. And when I went back to visit them in their retirement for the first time, I suddenly realised that although I hadn't thought about Cornwall for a long time, I knew it implicitly. I knew the sand, I knew the taste, almost literally, of the water, the way the salt becomes arcane in the palate. And so this reminded me of Plato's idea of anamnesis, which, as you may know, says that we all experience reality before we are born. And then when we're incarnated in this fleshy clay, we forget it, but we can remember it. And that the truth is not, as somebody said, out there, but is something which we can remember, or, as anamnesis puts it, unforget. Unforgetting. Flat, shining fields of sand, the shallow carving Tigris and Euphrates of the beach streams, where individual flying grains are seen, the wet compactions out of which grew keeps I used to raise with greyish slapped moat water, enthralled and never doubting I was loved. Blue-black rock, its surface softened by salt, like miniature coast the coming wave would ruin. Caves that had ground no man had trodden, all stored when the soul passed here before this life, restarted by a sleepy train's long snaking. The next poem is about the Romantic poets Wordsworth and Coleridge, but it's not really about them. It's really about two modes of being, and about how much, how even if, like me, you love long walks in the country and that sort of thing, sometimes nature can seem just a little muddy. It's a very short poem. There's only about probably 18 words in it, so I must try and make my introduction tactfully shorter than that. But you need to know that Wordsworth and his family ate a lot of porridge when they were in Dove Cottage. They ate it twice a day, which once drove poor Sir Walter Scott, who was staying with them and was going mad with porridge, to climb. He said, I'm off now to work on Ivanhoe, Wordsworth. See you at lunch. And we'll see you this evening. And in fact, he crawled out of the window and went down the road to the Swan Hotel and had a very meaty dinner, lunch. And it was only caught out when he and Wordsworth both ran into the innkeeper the next day, and the innkeeper said something terribly unfortunate, like, oh, you're not coming for your usual today, Sir Walter, or something like that. Lots of porridge. And I like the way that porridge sounds like Coleridge as well. Skiddaw, as you may know, is a very, very large, classic-looking mountain in the Lake District in the north of England. And the last line, the last word of the last line, refers to a terrible row that Wordsworth and Coleridge had, a terrible falling out from which they never quite recovered. And one of the causes of the falling out was the belief of Coleridge that Wordsworth had called him the last word in the poem. I broke my rule, didn't I? Here come the 19 words. Wordsworth and Coleridge. Insufficient the broad oaten flakes, the convictions plain as Skiddaw. How Coleridge would have loved neon, glutamates, and so many channels, intricate, hair-like, in the end, a nuisance. A Victorian Dreams of Heaven. Let heaven be a great sweet thaw, of love gone cold in time or the grave. Taking of hands never thought to be taken again. The old light in the eyes. Let heaven be a great sweet thaw of love made numb by jealousy. Love that dared not act because acting would scald and scar like fire. Let heaven be an utter release from fear. I live in a Victorian house very near a Victorian graveyard. Much of England is filled up with dead Victorians. It's quite true, and we can't be buried anymore because they've taken all the plots. It's perfectly true, we have to be cremated now. These imperial tombs are gradually being redesignated nature reserves, and very rare kinds of dormouse and beetle are allowed to multiply there. It's a poem, the next one, about how even if the god the Victorians in many cases felt they had lost, even if he doesn't exist, we still inevitably belong to the universe. Victorians. Near our Victorian house, Victorian graves. That age's loss of God can still be seen, a realism in the grains of the day, as though the heavenly glory has expired, leaving the railway and the angular cranes, the straggling blackberries and the merchant Thames. Slowly, I trawl an open hand along a cold, wet street sign, and the living carbon meets iron with a kind of holy aptness, far from ideas and far from centuries. I don't know if anyone particularly follows this or has noticed this, but we're down to the absolute last tiny bit of thread of living memory of World War I. There are only three people in the world who fought in the First World War, two of whom saw service, one of whom was an Englishman who now lives in Australia called Claude Chules, and one of whom is an American called Frank Buckles, who is 108 and has a very informative website about his time on the Western Front in 1917. So look up Frank Buckles. This is a composite poem of a couple of the last British veterans, including Chules. A British veteran. A hand that held a rifle on the climb to Passchendaele now bears a bubbling flute. His hand is strong and rubicund, his frame mobile and actual as he toasts his 8 Australian great-great-grandsons. Woolen cloth is covering his body now as then. That hand will soon slip under the stream of myth. No one thinks Agincourt was fought by men. This one, I'm pleased to say, is coming out in Agony very soon, if you want to follow it up. Two poems, short poems, about the things you find at the foot of gardens. Compost. Mounds like grey grass huts that grew at the foot of tidy gardens, forkable and moist, dilapidated, harmless, almost friendly, sweet mulching down of much that had been living. Hair that mounts up grey on a barber's floor. And the bonfire before lighting. Dropleted twigs with mouldy ashen coats jutted out with thorns, made caves within. A blackbird's corpse, a slow worm's, all would go. Dissolution, absolute absence of girders, of intellectual property, baroque scales. Here's a poem about our addiction to the news. I used to wake up to Radio 4 in Britain, if you've heard that, and you would wake up with a terrible jolt to Robin Cook or someone being grilled in the radio car, whatever that was. And it's a terrible way to wake up, and I now wake up to Radio 3. and consequently am planning to live a lot longer. I don't think we have to know everything first thing. I think it becomes a terribly anxiety-inducing habit, really. Unless, you know, the gunman's on our street, clearly that's different. Waking. Beside you in the landscape of the bed, a lightsome cellular warmth behind the eyes, balance and hunger, coolness on the covers, each muscle moved, a full, rewarding joy, half dreaming of tea with the distant and the dead, your flesh the colour of rose and half shadows, your warmth annihilating metaphysics, a great ring of light through a flaw in the window, and then the radio alarm clock coughs and brings our armour with the needless first word, gunmen. I'm very struck, this is my second visit to this bit of the world, and I'm very struck by how it really does look a lot like home in many ways. So I hope you'll forgive this little summer holiday around England. It starts in Cornwall, then goes to Kent, where I grew up, which is on the far east, southeastern tip, the Garden of England, they call it. And then to the Lake District in the north, and then to Oxford. July. Ice creams, veranda, sparkling Cornish Bay. Old men look jaunty classic in the sunlight. Roman consuls slightly down at heel. And children swim out to a floating platform beyond the boats with names of girls and fays. Out in the small, unwinding, vein-like lanes, where everything runs out before the sea, the chlorophyll in salty grass is yielding willingly to candescent, lifting light. Elsewhere, the verdant Agincourt discipline of men of Kent trees cut out from the pattern, long hourless afternoons in pubs on greens. And on the fell sides, nature at her gaudy, old Catholic colours in the sky and thorn, lake like a giant blue, tough-skinned, basking lizard. All colours thick as in a childhood film stock. In Oxford, students, sleek with many an A, dawdle down the river, playing their part. And languid fellows decorate the meadows. Imperial ironies are cultivated in their straw hats and floppy creasing suits. Summer professional yet legendary, great banner in the heavens, read by all. And I think two more. The next one is about, it might almost have had the title of Damien Hirst's Shark, which sounded like a bit of a scam, really, but I think in its presence it was very impressive. It was called, you know the one I mean, the pickled shark. And it was called, it looked very fierce, but it was in formaldehyde, and it didn't know it was dead. And it was called something like The Impossibility of Death in the Mind of Something Living. Sometimes when I wake up from my afternoon nap, I feel very Larkin-esque about death, really, which otherwise I don't. I feel very sad and, like, time's running out. So this is about waking up on the train to London. You and sunlight, houses and graves and motion, and with the must of ancient album pages, or the sense I am adrift upon an ocean, I feel a final hour has to come. But how can I conceive of such a stricture, who have a timeline of the Middle Ages, have watched so many aliens, and can picture Moses and Robespierre and the tribe of Gum? So we uncurl from seats as cramped as cribs, seeming to fall or sift as if through sieves. We walk beneath gigantic whale-like ribs, then step into the London afternoon like dauntless clerks of 1883, or smart young 60s TV executives dreaming of life in the 21st century. Open marriage, jetpacks on the moon. As Chandler, who I'm staying with, said last night, where's my jetpack? And finally, a walk in the Lake District, which, if you don't know, I hope you will visit one day. It's from the village of Ambleside to another village in Glen Ridding. There are various place names. Rydal Water and Brothers Water are lakes. Gold Rill and Scandale Beck are streams. Fairfield's a mountain. The Traveller's Rest is a pub. I think that's all you need to know. They're, I hope, happy incantations, even if you don't know the area. Ambleside to Glen Ridding, for the person who I did it with. How are you feeling? You all right? Good. Okay. Not in memory of, sorry. For Amanda Holton, Ambleside to Glen Ridding. The 18th century notes Rydal Water glittering in a prospect. By Scandale Beck, climb on a pony track past meteorite grottos to High Sweden Bridge, alone constructed eye, a glimpse of civilization. Then press on to a pre-human valley in the mountains, networked by veins of thin and plashable streams. Now up, an easy up, with Fairfield left, mist and moisture cool on grateful limb, loved wideness, thereness, love like sun on stone, to a broken ridge, the start of dirty walking, oikish grass and ankle-killing holes. But there is light and we have time and food. So Brothers Water inches round a hill, lake like a flat grey pebble, and reaching earth we head past waterfall and fiery fern, past Goldrill to the silver spill of Ullswater, its miles of absolute edge as mild as Jesus. Then to the Traveller's Rest for woods floor beer, rich seasoned beef, potatoes piping, whiskey and shortbread, fire and sugar for the next day. Thank you.
I'll ask our poets just to inquire of one another for a moment. Let's bear in mind that among the many auspices that we enjoy this evening, an important one is the sense of internationalisms, of nationalisms, of different places, of different times, of what combination of similitude and dissimilitude meets you when you go perhaps to the Netherlands, perhaps to America. That's one of the large areas that we should be thinking about, areas themselves. But let me just ask you if you have anything you would wish to put to Kieran about your sense of place in relation to civilization, a word that figured very important, and then vice versa.
You do something I wish I could do, which is to find and say what the meaning of a particular experience might be, and as it were. I don't know if that makes sense or if that's an accurate account. But Christopher said at the start that your work was Wordsworthian, and in fact, my memory of your reading in Balliol, and then again this time, was what kept coming into my mind was that one of my favorite Wordsworth poems, which is Old Man Traveling, Animal, yes, Tranquility and Decay.
Which you alluded to in your line about the line about the hospitals, I thought alluded to that.
Oh, my God, yes, you're
right. What's the line? Oh, have I just spotted there?
The time to build a hospital for travellers. But I hadn't been thinking
about
that.
Well, you know, I mean, there we go, travelling, and then the last line is... Yes. The last line is... they're going to what's the last Christmas?
And there is dying in a hospital.
Exactly.
Or and there is lying in a hospital.
Yes.
Because it's a very telling variant in, yes, the end of the poem.
Yes.
Well, and it's also such an interesting choice, like whether an editor will include. There are two versions of the poem. I'm sure most of you know this, but there are two versions of the poem. One that ends, and there is lying in a hospital, and the other which ends. I think it's six lines earlier, and just ends with Wordsworth's articulating his...
He is by nature led to be so perfect that the young behold with envy what the old man hardly feels. we rehearsed this extensively.
They didn't.
Please
they
do
really
not
didn't.
Be
they
taken
really
in.
Yeah. yes. So what was the final clause of your question?
Well, I just think that the choice between ending it with Wordsworth's thought about the old man and then ending it with the old man's words,
yes.
Enigmatically, somewhat flat, perhaps more flat, but certainly more shocking. The second version, I think that to end with one's own thought about the thing, I think is something that I wish I could do. For some reason, I try to, but it never seems to work. So, but I'm just curious about your. This is not really much of a question. It's sort of a ramble.
It's very flattering, and thank you. It's what I'd like to feel I did, although the way you phrased the question reminded me of Eliot's lines in, I think it's Dry South Ages, isn't it, about how we had the experience, or is that East Coker? We had the experience but missed the meaning. An approach to the meaning restores the experience in a different form beyond any meaning we can assign to happiness.
But it's
I remember wanting when I was an undergraduate very much to be able to. I aspired to looking something in the face in a poem, but I think the great danger is that one then becomes hectoring. And in fact, I've recently been trying to assemble a collection, and I had to cut about three or four poems. Because they were basically making the point in my poem Victorians about how we belong to the physical world, whether we like it or not, and that we're always at home here, inevitably. I felt I was making the same point over and over again, and I think the great danger with that approach of mine is that one becomes doctrinaire and repetitive. So that's the downside. But as long as I don't become that, I'm very happy.
Well, I don't think so.
Thank you.
But it is, in a way, also like the difference between the Eliot of the Wasteland and Eliot of the Four Quartets.
Yes, that's true. That's true. Which do you prefer? This is the... No, but people tend to like one or the other. And
I adore all of it.
Yeah.
But I suppose that the first Eliot that got to me when I was very was too young to understand anything was The Wasteland,
yes.
I suppose. So I suppose that is closer to my heart. But but very quickly, I love the Four Quartets as well.
It's very... To think about... I mean, genuinely, The Wasteland scares me now, and the idea... Well, by which I mean in a good way. I just find the language of The Wasteland, in the best possible sense, terrifying. What reading it in 1922 must have been like, I shudder to think it must have been... I mean, you can quite see why his reputation formed so quickly. I once asked... an old poet, old then, called Kathleen Rain, who at the time was 90, about reading The Wasteland in the 20s. And she was then part of a fashionable Cambridge set. And she said, well, we all thought, all the 20-year-olds thought, how can this American understand 20-year-olds in Britain so well? How can he know what we're going through? But then 70 years later, she said she had realised that actually he hadn't realised what they were going through at all. It had all just been some extraordinary tonal coincidence, and what he was writing about was something very private, and really it was his own, it was a spiritual autobiography, I think. Yes, it's very... Wouldn't it be interesting if Pound had been given a chance to get to the quartets? I mean, if we could have had a sort of two-book prelude and a 12-book prelude with the quartets, that would have been fun, wouldn't it? I once edited down The Wasteland just for fun, because it seemed a bit miserable. And if you know the poem and you just take out the lines that are not as cheerful as they could be, it begins, "Summer surprised us, coming over the Starnberger See with a shower of rain." And it ends, "I sat upon the shore fishing." And it's only about 35 lines long, but in some ways it's a much more satisfactory poem.
Thank you.
I am sorry. Christopher's currently editing the collected T.S. Eliot and probably wants to put in my version now. But
a final word from both of you, and then I'll have an even more final word.
Well, just quickly I'll let my final word be a reply, which is Marcia Karp, who's there in the back, and I and several other poets were asked to translate Anglo-Saxon riddles. Yeah. And one of the wonderful things, interesting things that the scholars before, and translators before us have articulated about the mystery of some of those Anglo-Saxon riddles is, if Adam was given the power to name all the animals, what would it be if they could all speak to us before they had their names? And I think that's what your question anyway reminded me of.
Thank you.
Well, I'd very much like to ask you, Saskia, what some of the options that people have suggested for the meaning of that Anglo-Saxon riddle you translated were, and what was going through your head?
It was a tough one.
What
it was the last one on the list that hadn't been claimed, I think. and I thought, oh, good, this is a good one. The reading I was most convinced by, and I read around, was prophetic dream. There are other possibilities: death, time, daylight, clouds.
Daylight. Yeah.
But prophetic dream was the one I was most convinced by.
Yes.
But it was hard, actually, to translate it without knowing what it was.
Yes.
Well, the imagination may be compared to Adam's dream. He awoke and found it truth. That's what Keats says. Eliot, you remember, the words sufficed to compel the recognition they preceded. It's very exact and very mysterious. Well, I think our poets have shown the way in which words can compel the recognition they precede. So please join me in thanking them.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've been listening to a reading and conversation presented by Boston University's Institute for Human Sciences and Center for International Relations in cooperation with the literary journal AGNI. Tonight's event was titled There Lives the Dearest Freshness Deep Down Things and featured poets Saskia Hamilton and Kieran Wynn. Our moderator was Christopher Ricks, William M. and Sarah B. Warren Professor of the Humanities at Boston University. We began with an introduction by Professor Vivian Schmidt, Director of Boston University's Center for International Relations. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Jared Mooney and Ryan Peterson. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.